Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. With Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Hey, listen. Don't listen. Look. Look at this light. It's not just daylight savings times. That's what it is. So Charlie says, you know, your plants are going to suffer because of daylight savings times.
Because it went away.
It went away.
They have less sun.
They have less sun. Of course, it doesn't happen because of daylight savings times, does it? Though it gets confusing.
No, it's because winter's coming.
It gets confusing. We got an hour earlier. But you know, the daylight savings times doesn't change the length of sun, does it? But yet, something weird is happening out there.
Can I share a quickie?
Yeah.
One of the things that I've started doing every morning about a half an hour before the sun comes up,
yeah,
go out on the deck, cup of coffee, and just look at the beautiful sky. It's a different panorama along with the songbirds every morning. What
yeah.
a way to start the day.
Yeah, it is great, and it's going to be a little easier to do that now, won't it? Because, unless you have to get up right before sunlight. But sunlight, man, it's the interesting thing that's happening this time of year. We talk about seasons, and when we talk about seasons, we suggest that seasons are about temperatures, right? We know that seasons are about temperatures, right? You know, seasons aren't really just about temperatures. They're about a lot of things happening at once. And the one thing we don't think about where seasons are concerned are seasons of light. And really, our seasons are driven as much by light as they are by temperatures, particularly in places like Mobile. Let me tell you about seasons in a place like Ireland. Can I talk about that for just a second? You know, there, and we all think that, you know, we all think seasons all over the world are just like seasons in Austria, right? They're just like seasons in Germany, right? Oh, heaven help us. Seasons are different everywhere in the world. But Ireland has its own set of seasons, and it's very interesting because in the Celtic tradition, which they're beginning to lose, because they want to be, you know, Irish, everybody wants to be like everybody else, and so we don't want to have our own seasons anymore. But in the old traditional Irish seasons, they were based on sunlight. They were based on sunlight, and it makes sense if you think about living in Ireland. The temperature in Ireland doesn't change much during the year. It's kind of chilly all the time. In fact, if you looked at Ireland, if you looked at it, its temperatures, at least its low temperatures, are pretty much like Florida. What do you think about that? It's pretty amazing, isn't it? Ireland's low temperatures are pretty much like Florida. They don't have much variation. They don't have really extreme lows in winter. And so it really isn't about the coldest parts of Ireland are like Mobile. That's the weird part. They don't have extremes of temperature at all. And so their seasons really aren't based on temperature. You could have Ireland can be green all year long. But somehow, at a certain time of the year, the grass quits growing. And the trees quit growing. And the potatoes quit growing. And what has happened? And that period of time is, I don't know if I can say this word out loud. I'm going to try it. It's Samhain. It's the festival. It's that great festival that sort of weirdly morphed into Halloween here, Samhain. And during this festival, Samhain, what we'll call it, it's as best I can do with Gaelic. During this festival, they celebrate the end of summer, It's on October 31st, and they're celebrating the end of summer. What's going on there? What has happened? Well, I'll tell you what. The light changes. The light starts changing dramatically. And so their days suddenly are less than 10 hours. And you know what happens if you're a plant? And the temperature is all the same, but daylight is changing, and daylight is decreasing rapidly at Samhain. And what is happening during November, December? They're not growing because they don't get enough sunlight.
Less photosynthesis.
Now, here's the interesting part that you don't think about. They're getting, on average, the difference, their long days are around 17 hours in midsummer. Their short days in winter are 7 hours. There's almost 10 hours difference in daylight between summer, long summer days in Ireland, and short summer days in winter. They recognize that that's important. That's a season. And in bulk, which I'll call it, which is sort of an Irish spring. That begins in February. It's when we should start thinking about our spring here, and it's about the light coming back. It isn't about the temperatures changing. It's about the light coming back. It's about the lambs. It's about the lambs having kids. And the pasture grass is growing enough to keep up with the kids that are developing in the pastures. That's about how they see seasons. Now look, let's come back, because here we are, and it's very interesting. We have these seasons of light, too, and they're very important to us, and we're going to talk a little bit more about them. But, you know, here's the thing. Here's another thing you don't think about. By December, by the middle part of December, Mobile is getting an hour more sunlight than places north of Washington, D.C., than places like New York. And Boston, an hour to an hour and a half more sunlight than New England. Wow. Each day, that's a big deal. Their days are dropping down close to 8 hours. Our days stay above 10. Wow. Seattle, I mean, we're talking 2 hours difference. Seattle, the days are so short in midwinter. Nobody thinks about growing things in midwinter in Seattle. I was reading some things about some advice from somebody in Seattle about how to grow things over the winter, because they have temperatures that are similar to ours in some ways. But they didn't try. They couldn't do anything. Nothing would grow because they're not getting enough sunlight. Our sunlight stays above 10 hours. Wow. Our sunlight, you know, the folks in Ohio who are growing things over winter, they have these great big banks of lights. It's not to keep the plants warm. It's so that the plants will have enough sunlight to keep them growing in their greenhouses. And if you try to, and they're trying to start seedlings, and if you're trying to imitate them, you've missed the point, because our time spans are very different because we're closer to the equator. Here's another thing to think about. Oh, I'm giving you a headache, aren't I? Listen, it's important to think about these things. This is about seasons. This is about how we interpret our seasons. You want to grow tomatoes in midwinter just like they grow in Homestead, Florida, and in Mexico. Well, you can do it. All you got to do is keep them warm, because that's the only thing that matters is temperature, right? You get the warmest greenhouse you possibly can. You just warm it up just toasty fine. And I guarantee you that even in Mobile, where our days are much, much longer than they are in Ohio, and much, much longer than they are in Ireland this time of year, even in Mobile, those tomatoes are going to quit producing fruit, even though they'll do it in Homestead, Florida. Because Homestead, Florida, the days are closer to an hour longer than they are here. You see what happens? You see what happens with this sunlight thing? You see how important it is? And we don't think about that. We don't think about how to take advantage of our place in the sun. And that's, you know, you've heard me say this before. It's fun to explore it, though. It's fun to begin to explore it. And right now, our days are beginning to shorten. It makes a lot of difference. A lot of things are blooming now that wouldn't bloom otherwise because they need shorter days because they're from near the equator. But it will. But our days are going to get so short that by mid-December, our days will be much shorter than days at the equator, much shorter than days in Mexico. And it's gonna be a big deal. A lot of these plants are gonna quit blooming. A lot of these plants are just they're gonna sit there in kind of a suspended animation for a few weeks. We got a plan for that. So why is all this happening? Well, I could be planetary. I'll try to be planetary when we come back, Greg. Hey, let's talk a little bit more about this and what it means for your garden. Let's talk about your garden. We'll be back. Give us a call, 251-343-0106. Nice music.
When the waters flow and the grasses grow in a free and easy way, give me enough of that plain old stuff that's made in Galway. Gauges open, gone and go, slag over late from blue. Give him a slip and we'll take a sip of that real old Mountain Dew.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, welcome back to the Gulf Coast. Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. Lots of questions here. You know, so I'm going to get planetary for just a minute. Let's look at what happens with light. I haven't seen the world from outside this planet. Maybe I should at some point. But here's what I perceive to be the issue. It's the it's the tilt of the sun. It's the tilt of the planet that makes the day length. And basically, if you look at it. The equator is always going to be the same distance, right, from the sun because it's sitting in the middle of the planet, basically. You see, there's a slight change, even just a few degrees north of the equator is a slight change. But basically, all daylight's the same, about 14 hours, 15 hours. And that's why 14 hours days are very important for things like poinsettias because they're used to slight variations in 14-hour days. They're not used to these long days. But then you get up to Ireland, and it's 17 hours in summer and 17-hour days. Can you imagine? And 7-hour days in winter because of this tilt. There it is. That's what's called. I believe that's true. Some astronomer who knows this better than I can help you to explain it. But there it is. It's a big difference in day length. But we are sort of somewhere in the middle of those two. We can certainly do things during winter that people in Ohio can't do. In fact, I think we can do things that people even in Tennessee can't do. We've got about 30 minutes more daylight in the middle of winter each day than people in northern Tennessee do. Maybe 45 minutes more than Maryland. So it's significant. You know, I talk to people sometimes. It's even distinctive. If you're in Huntsville and you're in Mobile, and I'm talking to somebody in Huntsville, and we're on different time zones, but we talk about the light, and they say, it's still light there in Mobile? And I say, yeah. Well, we're at different ends of the time zone a little bit. But boy, the difference in day length is significant, even there, 20, 25 minutes. And it makes a difference in what you grow. It makes a difference. You know, seasons are sometimes about light. That was the point here. And learning to take advantage of that light. So here's what, listen, so what am I telling you? I'm telling you, you have to mow your yard more here because, in part, our days are so dadgum long. It's not just the temperature. It's the fact that the light goes on and on and on. So the yard can keep growing, and it can't do that farther north because the days get too short. But that also means that you can grow vegetables through the winter with slight protection, just a little bit of protection, much better than people in Ohio, because our days are so much longer. It's not just about the temperature. It's about the sunlight. It also means that if you're thinking about ripening your tomatoes this time of year, you've got to remember that in Homestead, Florida, regardless of the temperature, they have longer days, which help them to ripen those tomatoes in a way that we can't do here. Just to explain some things. Let me, got a lot of callers. I want to, because I didn't do this last week, and I had a lady asking me about yesterday, today, and tomorrow. It took me a while to figure out what exactly, but we're talking about the plant yesterday, today, and tomorrow, Brunfelsia. Brunfelsia, if I remember correctly, is a member of the tomato family. And you know tomatoes are toxic. Well, in fact, some members of the Solanaceae, some members of the tomato family are toxic. That's why we thought tomatoes were toxic for a long time. They seem to have a certain type of toxicity to them. There are a lot of weeds in your yard that probably have a lot of toxic principle in them that are members of Solanaceae that wouldn't be good for your pets to eat. But the question is yesterday and tomorrow, yesterday, today, and tomorrow, Brunfelsia, the shrub, is it poisonous to dogs and cats? Yes, it can be. So I will tell you, yes, it can be. They've got to eat the stuff. And, you know, there's some dogs and cats who are just determined to eat bad stuff. I haven't figured it out. I mean, there's some dogs who wouldn't touch it. There's some dogs who wouldn't touch a cycad, but, boy, they're going to eat the Brunfelsia. Particularly the seeds can be very attractive. You know, I don't know whether they like the taste, but it can be toxic. It probably isn't. It can lead to some symptoms. It probably won't kill them, but yes, it can be toxic. So if you've got a dog or a cat and you think they don't have common sense, and sometimes they don't, they are prone to eating things they shouldn't. Well, you might have to think twice about Brunfelsia. I don't think I would worry about it too much. Because there's plenty of stuff to eat, and why they would pick on Brunfelsia is an interesting question. But there it is. Hope I answered that question. Taxman and I have got to talk persimmons. We're gonna talk about persimmons today. But Thomas, I want to get to your question. I'm listening. What's up?
All right. Thank you for having me on, Bill.
Yes, sir.
Happy Sunday.
Yes, sir.
Some of your music that you segue in and out of. Spent some time in North Central Arkansas. I was doing a paper and in the Ozarks. And is that some of the music from that area?
Well, you know, the music I've been playing is from the is from the Chocolate Drops, and they're a group from North Carolina. And what they've done is they've gone back into a strain of music that developed across the South. You know, the South developed a lot of musical strains. Nowadays, we listen to the TV and we listen to radio, and so we don't produce many musical.
Right, I thought it might have been.
Yeah, so it's a Southern. It's part of that complex. You know, and I think places like the Ozarks and the Appalachians held on to that music longer, in part because they were so isolated, and I can sort of remember this in Mississippi too.
They,
but they
couldn't sing a flip, could they?
Well, they couldn't. They couldn't hear the radio. So see, everybody entertained
the reason
themselves.
I called,
yeah,
is maybe you can identify this rose plant that came from China back in 1881. This young lady, she migrated and she ended up in southern Arizona in the silver town. It was silver camp, mining camp, Tombstone. And they didn't have schools, and the Indians were running around, the kids were running around, and she wanted to start schools and all. And it was a story about her mother back in Scotland. She had come from Scotland. had gotten a rose bush, a white rose bush this was, from China. And so she sent cuttings of a rose bush that was from China to southern Arizona. And the rose bush grew like crazy, and they started an inn right there where she had lived. It's the Rose Tree Inn. And as of about 45 years ago, I knew it was still open. I don't know if it's open anymore, but I was your train of thought of different plants in the planetary, like from China. What they can live elsewhere? Do you have any idea what kind of rose bush that was?
Well, it's a big world with lots and lots of different kinds of plants and lots of different kinds of roses. I'm listening to you, and I'm thinking there could be a lot of. I couldn't tell you precisely. I'd have to go there and figure it out. A lot of our roses that we now grow.
I don't have any money for you to go to Arizona.
Yeah, a lot of our roses that we grow come from China. China, and it's very interesting. Southern roses, which we've largely abandoned, because we always do whatever people in Boston are doing because we think they know best. Sometimes they do, maybe. But not when it comes to gardens. And so we always ape whatever somebody in Connecticut wrote about. And so we forgot our southern roses. But most southern roses came from South China. And the roses that we grew that were very popular here. And there are hundreds.
Wow.
Hundreds. Wow. It transformed the way we looked at growing roses here. I gotta take a break. It sounds like it. Yeah, no, we're going to take a break, and we're going to come right back. If you can hold on, Thomas, just a second. Jim, hold on.
Surely, thank you.
Yeah.
6 foot, 7 foot, 8 foot punch. Daylight come and we won't go home. 6 foot, 7 foot, 8 foot punch. Daylight come and we won't go home.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
I think we got a lot to talk about because these little segments are going by awful fast here, Charlie. Thomas, let's get back to these roses real quick. So
Okay. All
these roses were from China that really we picked up in the 19th century, and there are some great ones that I love. Mrs. B.R. Cant. One of my favorites. It's a pink rose, big pink cabbage rose. It's blooming right now in my yard, and boy, is it stupendous. It gets so big, and I thought, I'm just going to kill it back, and I cut it all to pieces, and it sprouted and did great, and now I don't know. She just won't let me alone. So I'm going to have to leave her alone and just let her grow, I guess. It's beautiful, but there are some great China roses that came to the South. A lot of roses that we consider native roses. We have some great native roses, but the ones that we consider native are, in fact, many of them are from China, like Cherokee rose. The rose we call Cherokee rose is also from China. It was escaped, and I'm kind of wondering if the rose that we're seeing in Arizona isn't what we call the Cherokee rose, because it came over early time. But I have to see the rose. I have to know it. There's a lot of roses out there. I mean, literally hundreds of them from that time period. We've lost a lot of them. But let me put in a plug right now, particularly if you live in an area where if you got pretty good air circulation in your yard, you don't mind adding some calcium and some other things to your soil, then I Antique Roses of Texas, the Antique Rose Emporium, has done a really great job of keeping some of these old roses in circulation, Antique Rose Emporium. And it's a great place to look for these old-fashioned roses that do well for us. Not the roses that do well up north, which are different, but the roses that the tropical roses, essentially, the subtropical roses that do very well only here in the South. And that's probably what you got there.
Well, Bill, thank you very much for your time. Coincidentally, my wife is 1/8 Cherokee. Isn't that something?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's her right leg from her knee down through her ankle. And she wears a moccasin on that foot. And on the other foot, she wears a New Balance sneaker. And it would attract it to me, too. Her is that she can outrun a wheelchair.
All right, that's great. Thomas, it's good to hear from you. Hey, Jim, it's always good to hear from you. What's going on?
It's getting nice. Getting nice.
It is.
Everything's getting a little shorter, though. The shadows are coming across the fields much earlier than just a couple of weeks ago.
That's right. It's amazing how fast it happens.
I wanted to ask a question this morning about, citrus in particular, but plants in general, and potting, repotting this time of year. Are there any precautions that we can take to decrease the root rot and things of that sort if we're kind of forced to do this whether we want to or not?
Jim, you know, this is an excellent question, and I always debate myself, should I let plants go through the winter, tropical plants go through the winter on old soil, or should I go ahead and change the soil now? Because they're not, you know, the ground, if you can, it's an interesting question. I think there is somewhat of a debate, but I think I would err on the side of changing the soil. Because if your soil has gotten, and Jim brings up an excellent point, we get a lot of rainfall. Have y'all noticed that? Anybody noticed that? We get more rainfall down here than just about any place else in North America. And we get that extra rainfall. We're getting twice as much rainfall as places like, as places like Ohio, Northern Ohio, and places like that. So that extra rainfall means that your soil and the high temperatures that last a long, long time means that the soil in your pots deteriorates and collapses and gets denser and wetter. And wet soil in a pot during winter is, not a good thing. It can cause root rot, and it certainly has and certainly does on some of my plants. So the question, going into winter, sometimes it's good to change the soil. And, Jim, I don't know. I mean, what are you thinking? I mean, my bias is go ahead and change the soil if you think it's going to stay sopping wet. But what are you thinking?
Well, I've got some plants that have stepped up on me and gotten kind of root bound.
Yeah.
And I'm just not so sure that we're not going to lose vegetation by spring if I wait to change.
Right.
I do need to do some root pruning, but I would suspect it'd be a good idea to keep it to a minimum.
Right.
And I can control the amount of water they get. I have places where I can, if we're getting too much rain, I can put them where we minimize the water that gets through the pot, at least in the short term anyway. I can't do it all winter. Spring is a terribly busy time for me, and it's just very difficult to get it done. And
I'd
like to see them hit the ground running in the spring when things start to warm up and
I know how you
sunshine
feel.
Gets better and that sort of thing.
You know, one of the problems is, and so, you know, the answer may vary depending on the person. And knowing that you watch the water, I might say wait until spring, but make sure that you appreciate that spring is February. But here's the downside to doing it this time of year. You want those roots to recover. You want them to start growing out. But if the soil stays too cold, they're not going to recover very well. I think in general, the soil will probably stay warm enough that we'll get some recovery. You don't want to just superheat the plant, because if you do, then it's not going to have, you know, it's not going to be, it's going to be very vulnerable to cold. So you're in this balance. Well, shoot, should I keep the soil a little warmer so the roots begin to recover and begin developing? Or should I let the plant go into dormancy? And that's the trick. So in general, so I made a good argument for why you might want to do it now if you're a person who tends to overwater. If you're a person who's watching the water carefully, then I might say, you know, wait until February, and maybe even late January, because here's the key to me is that the roots are going to take. It's going to take about a month for the roots to start growing back. Anyway, it's just going to take that little bit of time, and so, you know, if you did it in February, the roots would start growing back out about the time that the temperature is going to get warm. And that's going to be, you're going to hit it just about right. So maybe I would say February is a good time for you to do it, if that helps with your schedule any, does it?
It would help some. It would help some. It's just that, you know, I don't want to fertilize too early.
That's right.
In the spring, because we get these, being a little further north than you are, we get these cold fronts that come through, and it'll drop down below freezing.
That's right.
And I don't want to. I don't want to be bringing things in, you know, or covering them constantly. But it's usually a one night thing. But as you know, it only takes one night to mess something up.
So. Right. Well, here's another thought. Just another thought, because this is you're intriguing me with this question, Jim, as you always do. here's another thought. One, when you trim roots, and a lot of times we're trimming with citrus, and Jim's growing lots of things in pots. We should explain this. Jim's growing lots of different kinds of things in containers in Atmore, a little far north of where most people would say these plants should grow. But he manages them in the ground and in containers. But when you have to, if you grow a citrus in a container, you every year or 2 years, maybe you could go 3 years, but it would be dangerous. You've got to go in and you've got to root prune that plant and repot it in the pot. Now, if you could go up to a larger size plot, but mostly you need to knock off some of that old dirt, trim the roots back, and repot it in fresh soil. There are a lot of reasons we do that. But what happens is when you trim those roots, you don't want to water heavily initially. That's very interesting. You want those roots to kind of callus over. So you want to go about 2 weeks where you don't water very well. So give your plant plenty of water so that before you do this. And then when you prune, you want those roots to callus over just a little bit where you've trimmed them. So don't water a lot. Let them callus over, get a little bit of a scab on it, so that they don't develop root rot. So you don't want to water excessively, and you don't want to add a lot of nitrogen. Now, here's the interesting part, of course, Jim, is that means you may have to make your own soil, because Walmart and Kmart and all the other whatevers they are now have all decided that we all want fertilizer in our soil packages, which we don't sometimes. So it can be dangerous, you're right. But if you can make your own soil and don't add fertilizer to it, that's probably the best thing. And then it would be okay to do it in February.
Well, actually, I have my soil already made.
So great.
I actually made it back in the early summer and just never could get the time to actually repot.
Yeah.
So I make all my soil anyway.
Yeah, so you're set.
I don't buy soil anymore. I quit.
Yeah, that's right. And I'm going to have to start making my own soil. I can't get out to Oliver's enough, and it's just a smart thing to do. Oliver has a great mix. Oliver has fertilizer in his too, and so that means you want to be a little careful. So I would say if you're not adding fertilizer to the mix, you could do it. I wouldn't be worried, or even just I wouldn't be worried about going ahead and putting and transplanting in February. I think that's – I'm going to say that that's probably a good time to think about it is February.
Okay.
And you'll have to watch. You're not going to force a lot of growth if you don't add a lot of water. And you'll kind of get through that March hump with your frost up there. And they'll be ready to go. They'll be ready to really start growing in April. And that's when you need to fertilize, is that late March window.
Sure. One quick comment might help folks in making soil.
Yeah.
If you have access to a cement mixer, just a portable, like home-type cement mixer,
yeah,
it greatly speeds the mixing and makes it a lot easier.
You know, I wish I had and I don't have a concrete mixer. It would be so easy. What I have to do is I have two big garbage cans. And I pour the soil back and forth between the garbage cans, which is I'm getting too old to do that, Jim.
Aren't we all?
So there it is. I need to get a concrete mixer. That's the key. Hey, Jim, have a good winter. Stay in touch with us and tell us how things are going. It's always good to hear from you.
It's always great to talk to you. And I always learn a lot when I do. People just listen. They can save themselves a lot of trouble.
Thanks, Jim. All right, folks, we're going to be back here. Charlie, we're fixing to take a break?
Yep.
There's that break. I told you.
If it keeps on raining, levee's going to break. And the water gonna come and I have no place to stay. Well, all last night I sat on the levee and moaned. Well, all last night I sat on the levee and moaned. Thinking about my baby and my happy home. If it keeps on raining, levee's going to break. If it keeps on raining, levee's going to break. And all these people have no place to stay. Now look here, mama, what am I to do? Now look here, mama, what am I to do?
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Okay, let's get back. Boy, we just got tons of things to talk about. And Tara, I'm coming right on. I wanted to, Chris over there in Saraland has sent me a picture of something that's in fruit right now all over Alabama. It's a very special, weird plant. Grows like, you know, it may be the plant that is just about everywhere I go in Alabama. It's the one plant I can count on seeing. It's very interesting. Up in northeast Alabama, just like it is here in southwest Alabama. Calocarpa americana. And that's the Latin name. It goes by a thousand names. In the fancy books, they call it beauty berry. My dad grew up calling it beer berry. Which, if you listen to a South Mississippi accent, it might come out as bearberry. And so you weren't sure whether he was quite saying bearberry or beerberry, but it's beerberry, I think, because it was actually used to make beer. It actually is a great insecticide. We're now finding out that Calocarpa americana, beauty berry, with these purple magenta berries, really just covered in it right now, if you see them in your own yards, little clusters of them all around the stem, that the leaves and the fruits can make a good insecticide that's very effective. It's what, if you're out in the woods, you need something, you can kind of rub that purple juice all over you and the leaves all over you. How's that? The fruit, actually like the fruit. It has a peculiar taste, a very interesting taste, but actually would make a really nice, I can see where it would make a nice beer. I have not seen any of my brewers, my friends the brewers. We should persuade them. Am I going to convince them or persuade them or something to, I'm going to persuade them so that they will be convinced to brew beerberry beer. How's that? So there's an interesting story there for you. Chris, cool plant. I want to talk about that Nankeen cotton there. We're going to come back and do that. But Tara, I want to talk to you. What's up?
Well, interestingly enough, part of my question is American Beauty Bush.
Okay.
You're calling it beerberry also?
That's what my dad called it, and it's apparently an old name here in the South. It was called beerberry, and it was you know, he being a Baptist had pronounced it in such a way that you could interpret it to be bearberry because no Baptist wanted to acknowledge that you could actually make a plant, a beer out of a plant. But beerberry was the old name. Beerberry was the old name.
Wow. Interesting, since I think that, you know, in part of the little sip of wine thing, part of the ritual of being Baptist?
No, that is for those of you who are not Baptist, you will want to know.
Well, I only was
that is,
for a while.
That is Welch's grape juice.
Well, no, I was, but before it was wild. Anyway, I don't want to get distracted by that. My question is, now that we are having fruitings of a lot of things, including American beauty bush, is what I call it.
Or beautyberry. Beautyberry is kind of the, yeah, good.
Yeah, and monkey grass, which I think has, you know, other names also, and lantana. Now, do the fruitings of, which happens only at this time of year, of these, the berries, the fruitings of these plants, need to be bird and or animal digested to seed and sprout? Because there are some that I want to encourage and some I want to discourage.
Well,
what locally does and does not work.
You know, I have never tried to sow beautyberry because it sows itself so well. And I don't really know that it needs to be go through the bird's digestive tract. Lantana is likewise. I think it probably just sows itself pretty well without a lot of effort. So, you know.
And monkey grass was the other one.
Monkey grass is almost entirely vegetative. It never spreads through seeds. I know it produces seeds occasionally, but it is entirely vegetative. That is, it's all growing from the roots and spreading from the roots.
Wow. Okay, so then I've heard that maybe the berries are poisonous to your pets, and I don't want my dogs left to eat them. But they're what can I say? They're idiot dogs like me.
Well, here's what I would say. So
here's
an interesting thing. I don't know. You know, there's lots of toxic things out there. If pets were going to die from eating monkey grass, there'd be dead pets all over. Because monkey grass is all over.
Okay.
And here's the thing. They don't produce that many berries, and you'd have to have a mighty tiny little dog to get sick.
I
on
do.
This. Yeah, so it'd have to be really tiny. But but no, I don't think – I would not worry about larapi or monkey grass. Brunfelsia, I'm sort of the jury's still out on it. But
So if you wanted to encourage the beauty bush –
yeah,
and you would try to encapsulate the encourage the beauty bush. You would try to throw those seeds down in places where you thought you might want them.
Right.
And if you wanted to discourage the lantana, you would try to encapsulate the clippings that you're doing down, and make sure that they don't get into areas where you don't want them. Am I understanding?
Well, yeah, you know, yes. I mean, lantana berries spread like wildfire. Birds do spread them. I don't know that they need birds to spread them, but birds do spread them all the time.
And squirrels.
And so they do show up. But, yeah, you want to keep that lantana from fruiting, and the only way to do that is to keep it from flowering, and the only effective way to do that is to dig it up and throw it in the trash. So
you don't got no butterflies.
Oh, there's lots of things for butterflies that aren't invasive,
yeah,
like lantanas.
Yeah, that's true.
But if I'm telling you, I don't think there's an easy way to deal with lantanas except to get rid of them if you don't want more of them.
I've done both.
Yeah.
And thank you so much for your really extensive and convincing answers.
My blunt answers about lantana. Well, I try to be generous to lantana, but then when you try to weed it out, it's hard to be generous to lantana because it's prickly,
it's hard to be generous to anything that's going to overtake everything else,
yeah,
including things like Monarda, you know, the milk thistle, you know, stuff. It's wonderful. You want to have the hummingbirds and four o'clocks. You want to have the hummingbirds and the butterflies and the wasps and all the pollinators, but sometimes you just got to go grit your teeth.
Yeah, but in defense of Monarda, compared to pulling up Monarda, compared to pulling up lantana, which would you choose?
Lantana first.
All right.
Unfortunately. All right. Thank you, sir.
Good to hear from you, Terry. Have we got time for Michael? No, Michael, shoot. I got to take a break. I don't know what's happening to the time here. You know, it's daylight savings times. It's taking 5 minutes off of each of our normal breaks.
The clock runs faster on standard time.
I think so. Oh, that's nice to hear this. Listen to this. Hey, David, boy, I'm glad you sent me a picture. My sugar cane's doing great. But we'll be back, folks. Got lots of questions. We're going to be back and enjoy them all.